Well, may the gods of Egypt and Syria go with her, and offer her my majesty's felicitations on her coming marriage, which will surely be a joyous one. The voice dripped mockery, and the beautiful lips twisted in a smile remarkably like the one carving furrows on the dark countenance of Count Senmut behind her. Mara felt her optimism drain away in spite of all she could do, and the sight of the white mask, which was Inanni's face, lowered her spirit still further. Friendless, homesick, unfortunate princess. Small wonder she had been unable to swallow the wine. Inanni managed to stammer out her thanks and farewells, and Mara translated with an effort. Hatshepsut nodded, and her smile grew broader. She began to laugh deep in her throat. The sound grew in volume until the chamber was filled with it. Mara found herself remembering the scream of Horus, the royal falcon, as he plummeted down from the sky that morning to seize the lark. Her flesh was creeping as she rose from her knees at last to back slowly toward the door beside the pallid Inanni. For the queen, still laughing, had raised her gold and enameled scepter. The audience was over. Chapter 9. Lion in a Snare. Inanni's summons from her intended bridegroom came within the hour. By that time, the effect of the queen's laughter had worn off, leaving Mara free of forebodings and once more impudently confident of herself and her wits. And anticipation of the ironic encounter just ahead, in which she herself would become the messenger she had been ordered to discover and betray, fairly intoxicated her. What delicious mischief! It was really too bad there was no one to enjoy it but herself. But then she reflected. Neither Sheftu nor her granite-jawed master would be likely to see the humor of the situation. Poor Inanni, having no secret deviltries to buoy her up, was in low spirits indeed. It was all Mara could do to convince her that she must submit to more unreasonable washing and hair-combing, and be ready after the noon meal to present herself to the king. But Mara had a firm way with her, and the food did much to restore the princess's quailing spirits. So, when enough water had trickled into the water clock to raise the level to the proper mark, Inanni rose, and accompanied by Mara and two of the Syrian women, followed another chamberlain through the gleaming halls wainscoted in gold leaf, through gardens and passages and rooms of state, to the apartments of the king. It was easy to see the position to which Thutmose had been reduced in this stronghold of his sister's. His rooms were lavish and his slaves numerous, but the atmosphere of his apartments was that of a luxurious prison. The guards, one felt, were less to keep intruders out than to keep Thutmose in. As for the interview itself, it was quite lacking in the ceremonious pomp that had characterized the queen's audience. Thutmose inspired not awe, but sound respect, as Mara found when he strode into the room, attended by only a couple of slaves and a scribe. He was a short, powerfully built man, with the nose of a conqueror, vigorous and restless in all his movements. As soon as she saw him, Mara began to understand Sheftu's fanatic loyalty, for the fire in those direct brown eyes caught the imagination and held it.
"So this is the barbarian," he growled, stopping before Inanni and letting his scornful gaze travel over her. "Monstrous! Exactly the bride I would expect my insufferable sister to choose for me, as though I would heed any choice of hers. Pah! Send the wretched creature away."
He turned and started back toward the room he had just quitted, then changed his mind and swung around to Mara.
"Who may you be?"
he demanded. "Mara, the interpreter," breathed the girl in relief.
For a moment, she had thought the interview already ended and her chance lost.
"Interpreter? What need of that? I know Babylonian, though I care not for it overmuch. A mumbling language."
Mara thought fast. Already he was poised to leave again, and he must not. She bent her head deferentially. "Even Her Most Glorious Majesty must have realized that His Highness would not deign to speak to this lowly Syrian in her own tongue." The words pleased him. He wrung few enough concessions from his iron-willed sister. Even this indirect acknowledgment of his royal status was a victory of sorts. He looked at Mara with more interest.
"Hatshepsut is right, for once," he remarked.
"However, even with an interpreter at hand, I have naught to say to this goatherd's daughter. You might tell her that I have no intention of marrying her, now or ever."
Mara turned reluctantly to Anani, who was staring miserably at the floor. She had not needed to understand his words to know that Thutmose despised her. His first scornful scrutiny had told her that.
"My princess," began Mara, then found she could not speak the crushing phrases. "His Highness presents his warmest regards," she finished. She had the satisfaction of seeing Anani's face come back to life. The great dark eyes lost their look of suffering and turned hopefully toward the king. Mara turned to him too, well pleased with her merciful little lie. But one look at his startled face froze the blood in her veins. What a fool she was! Of course he had understood every word she had said.
"Son of Pharaoh, live forever," she gasped. "I crave pardon. I could not believe you meant to wound this princess, however lowly."
"You mean you forgot I could understand," retorted Thutmose.
"By the feather of truth, Highness, I meant only to spare this unfortunate maiden who is homesick and frightened and who has met only contempt in the land of Egypt. I pity her and could not tell her that all her journey was in vain. Not here, where your Highness and these others are all watching her. Pray give me leave to do it later, in private."
She broke off, breathing hard. She had been unthinkably bold. She knew that from the horrified expression on the little scribe's face. He stepped up to the king, bristling.
"Your Highness, this impertinence is intolerable. With your leave, I shall have this person removed at once, and shall myself see to it that—"
"Be silent," said Thutmose.
Without taking his eyes off Mara, he swept the scribe into the background with one powerful arm.
"Leave me. Take these others with you."
The room was soon empty of all save the three Syrians, the king, and Mara. Thutmose took a step nearer, his eyes still boring into hers.
"Now, little one," he said quietly, "perhaps you will tell me who you really are."
Inanni spoke up.
"What does he say, Mara? Why do you not translate?"
Mara managed to control her delight long enough to answer rapidly.
"He wishes to know if you are more comfortable with all those others out of the room."
Why, yes, Mara. Tell him I am much more comfortable."
Thutmose ignored her.
"Hasten, girl. They will not stay away forever. Who are you?"
"The princess's interpreter, Highness, but also yours to command."
"At last! I thought as much the instant—"
Thutmose broke off, his face tightening.
"How do I know this?"
For a moment, Mara was at a loss. She had no talisman, no sign, no proof save Sheftu's name itself.
"By him who sent me, son of Pharaoh," she answered. "By—"
"Name me no names. The very walls are spies. Describe him if you can."
Inanni was tugging at her sleeve.
Mara turned hastily, trying to assemble her thoughts. "My princess, your bridegroom, inquires if you have a
slept well, if your rooms are to your liking.
Oh, indeed they are. It is only the beasts on the couch which...
No, wait, Mara. Perhaps we should not mention the beasts.
I merely say that the rooms please me very much.
Describe Sheftu? Mara was thinking. As well describe the shape of the wind. Would she describe the gold-hung noble, or the scribe's apprentice she had first seen bending over her on the deck of the Silver Beetle? She began hesitantly.
He is young and tall, Highness, and well-favored, with eyes like the night.
But that told nothing of him, true though it was.
She pictured again the river lights playing over his face, felt his dangerous charm, remembered with a chill the porter's grasp of his shapely hand.
He is one to beware. There is a laziness about the way he moves. I cannot say it as I would. In a crowd he looks the same as other men, but he is not. By the feather, he is different from any I ever knew. When he smiles, I know not how to tell you of his smile. It is like a magician's potion.
She stopped in confusion at the amusement on the king's face.
He was not described quite thus by the last messenger, who was elderly and male,
said Thutmose dryly.
However, I recognize my artful one. Well favored is he. In truth, he is almost ugly, but no woman ever knows it. Tell me, is he safe?
Aye, he is safe, mumbled Mara.
So far, she thought vindictively. Why had she made such a fool of herself?
And well?
Translate, Mara, pleaded Anani.
My princess, the son of Pharaoh inquires after the health of thy brothers.
Anani looked wonderingly from her to the king.
Tell him they flourish like the palm. But how long he talked to say such a simple thing. In truth, Mara, this conversation is exceeding strange. His words speak one thing and his face another. Look how he scowls. Is it always so with Egyptians?
Frequently, Highness. Our language is more complex than thine.
Mara groped after her scattered wits, wishing the princess at the bottom of the Nile. Between Inanni's questions and the king's irony, she felt like a juggler with too many balls in the air. Now, somehow, she must explain away Thutmose's ill-concealed impatience. Look at him glowering there. In truth, he was small help to her.
She invented hastily. In addition, my princess, his highness, complained of a slight headache, which I forgot to mention. He begs you not to judge his gallantry by a scowl.
A headache? Inanni was instantly concerned.
Why, what a pity. No wonder he... Mara, ask him if he has tried a remedy made of the crushed pods of the poppy.
Mara faced the king, wrenching her mind back to the last question he had asked. If Sheftu was well. In Egyptian, she answered it.
Aye, he who sent me is in the bloom of health.
Hi, the gods be praised. Tell me, blue-eyed one, where did he find you?
On a Nile boat called the Silver Beetle, we happened to travel together up the river, and met quite by chance.
By chance, eh? I'll wager nothing was left to chance from then on. He's thorough, that one. I wonder what axe he's found to hold over your pretty head. Perhaps not but those night-black eyes.
Thutmose chuckled, but waved back her retort.
Never mind. I'm sure of him, therefore of you. You may give...
He stopped, jerking his head irritably at Anani, who was showing signs of impatience.
Proceed with your sweet Babylonian nothings on my behalf, then give me his message.
What did he say, Mara? Has he tried the poppy pods?
No, my princess. He has never heard of such a remedy. He says he will consult the royal physician about it and is touched by your interest in his welfare.
Are you sure, Mara? He does not look touched, only angry.
Aye, but that is his headache. Indeed, he is not only touched, but smitten with your highness. He expressed great astonishment that one so comely should also have a warm heart. Inanni began to glow.
Comely? Did he call me so? Indeed, then he cannot be angry after all. I believe he is lonely, Mara. He needs a woman to care for him. That's what it is. None of these cold Egyptian beauties, but someone to love and soothe him. Tell him I will prepare the poppy draft with my own hands, and no other shall touch it. How I misjudged him. He is kindness itself, and so handsome. Is he not handsome, Mara?
Murmuring agreement, Mara turned with some nervousness to the startled Thutmose.
"Pray restrain yourself," he told her. "You will have this fat Syrian in my arms. Come, give me the message, and hasten. Our privacy will not last."
"The war hawk is coming."
An instantaneous change came over Thutmose.
"Amen be blessed!"
he exclaimed. He gnawed his lip a moment, staring at nothing, and Mara could feel herself and Inanni recede into a limbo of unimportance. Suddenly, he whirled and began to pace up and down, until she was reminded of a panther in a cage. Inanni turned to her, bewildered.
"Why does he act so, Mara? What did he say?"
"That he is overjoyed with your offer to prepare the poppy pods. He is now trying to remember whether there are any in the palace storerooms."
"Oh, he need not worry over that. My women brought plenty from the homeland. Tell him the draft will be here within the hour."
Mara hesitated. The king's preoccupied scowl was formidable. She knew he had forgotten their very existence. But Inanni urged her impatiently.
"Tell him, Mara."
"Son of Pharaoh," Mara ventured.
"I crave pardon, but I must speak, lest this maiden grow suspicious."
What?
"Will your highness allow her to prepare this draft?"
Aye, let her do what she likes. The war hawk.
Thutmose kept on pacing.
"That was the exact wording of the message?"
"Aye, your highness."
"By Amun, that even my clever one should have such powers of persuasion. I begin to think he is the great magician himself. And indeed he'll have to be. We must have gold now. Much and more than much. Tell him that. Ask him..."
The king halted beside a table, his back to Mara. He picked up a papyrus that lay there, turned it absently in his fingers a moment, then tossed it down again.
"Ask him," he went on quietly, "if his magic is indeed a shield and a buckler to him. For he must go on a far journey. There is one, and only one, in the land of Egypt who will give gold for my sake, and who has enough."
He paused again, as if reluctant to go on. Mara mechanically invented some fiction or other for Inanni, but her attention remained on the king. A far journey? What was he talking about? There was something strange in his manner, an air of dread coupled with grim resolve that promised no easy task for Sheftu. Suddenly, Thutmose whirled and planted his feet.
"Thou of the blue eyes,"
he said with quiet menace,
"thy life is worth less than nothing should this reach any ears but his. Do you understand that?"
Mara nodded, shrinking back a little. His glare was frightening.
"Then here is the message. Tell him he must journey to the River of Darkness, as we talked of long ago. He must take the treasure of him who sleeps there. Even the royal cobra from his brow, and the collar of amulets."
"River of Darkness?" Mara choked on the words.
"Aye, he must take from the dead the gold Egypt must have to live. He must go down into the land of night and bring it forth to me."
There was a cold emptiness in the pit of Mara's stomach. Sheftu's orders were to commit the foulest crime known to Egypt, to rob a pharaoh's tomb. He must break open doors once sealed with prayers and chanting for all eternity, descend into echoing silence, deepest night, creep through rooms and passages and darkest mystery to the farthest chamber, where Pharaoh dwelt amid his treasure. And he would die there, trying to wrest it from the chefs who guarded it. He will never come back, thought Mara. Thutmose watched her narrowly a moment as she stood sick and numb with what she had heard. Softly, he added,
"He knows which door to enter."
Then he jerked away to a wine stand at the other side of the room, tore the garlands off the jug, and splashed a cupful of the amber liquid.
"You may arrange audience for this Syrian whenever you need to see me," he rapped out. "Be gone now."
Mara managed to stammer something to the puzzled Inanni, and they withdrew. The king did not acknowledge their farewells. When they left the room, he was still standing with his back to them and his head bent, turning the empty wine cup over and over in his hands. Mara never knew quite how she explained that last few minutes to Inanni's satisfaction, or to what mingling of headache and ardor she attributed the king's behavior. But the words must have convinced Inanni, for the farther she progressed down the halls and passages to her own apartments, the wider she smiled and the faster she walked. Flushed and talkative, she summoned her women as soon as she reached her suite and immediately set them to preparing the poppy pod headache potion.
"Quickly, Ezra, the finest pod you brought from the homeland, and a little mortar and pestle. Dashtar, fetch a flagon of water and the cup that measures its own contents, for we must know to the width of a hair, lest the draft be too potent. His Highness will find relief soon. I am sure of it. He is so kind. I cannot tell you how thoughtful he was of my comfort. But he is a strange man, nonetheless, scowling and sudden. I was half frightened of him at first. It was his headache that made him so. How he paces, up and down, up and down." The quick, excited voice ran on. The plump fingers worked diligently with the pestle. The room was full of the mumbling hiss of Babylonian comment, exclamation, and question. At last, Inanni had something to talk about, and something to do. She was happier than at any time since leaving Syria. Not so, Mara. The interview with Thutmose had so disturbed her that she could barely keep up the pretense of listening to the women's chatter. Surely Sheftu would not obey that terrible command. Of all crimes in the land of Kempt, tomb-robbing was the most monstrous, a sin against living and dead, gods and man. Even earthly punishment for it was swift and fearful. But what of the vengeance of him who was robbed? Hidden and safe in his secret palace, he lay wrapped in linen and spices, the cobra of Egypt on his forehead, and his storerooms filled with the wealth that would sustain him in luxury through his allotted 3,000 years in the land of the West. Would not his ka strike Sheftu blind or dumb for daring to enter the precious habitation? Would it not creep like a shadow into his body to waste him with illness, to steal away his soul, to bring him down in all his youth to that mooring in the land of silence from whose shore none ever returned? Nay, it was more than should be asked of any man, even for his king. "Put it out of your mind," Mara told herself fiercely. "Sheftu will not obey. If he does, then it is his concern and none of yours. Look out for yourself, and let others do the same." But the old formula did not comfort her this time, nor did the sight of Inanni's joyful face as she labored over the poppy pods and repeated for the admiring Syrians every smallest word of the conversation she believed she had held with the king. A cruel deception that had been, to raise her hopes when there was nothing real to hope for. Mara was not proud of her handiwork.
Surely there must have been some other way. But faced with that pacing lion of a man and two conversations to keep up in as many languages, who could have hit on it? She found she could not bear to hear for the third time how kind and how handsome His Highness was. Pleading a need for rest, she excused herself and went into her own room. "What heft has entered into me?" she thought angrily, flinging herself down on her couch. "Perhaps too much royalty in one day has given me a fever, that I should fret about a fat barbarian and her feelings. This queen, this king, this princess, this great lord Sheftu, what have they to do with me and my plans? I must beware of them, that's all. They are strangers, they are enemies. I must never forget it." Steadied, she sat up and pushed the thick, ebony black hair away from her face. She would summon little Nessie to dress it. That would be a diversion. She would put on fresh clothes and have her feet bathed and her eyes bathed, and the long black line of coal painted fresh above her lashes, and demand a blue lotus to wear upon her brow, as the great ladies wore them, with its stem trailing down the back of her head. Soon, it would be time for the evening meal, then for that walk in the lotus garden. She must be ready for it. She rose and clapped her hands for her slave. Chapter 10 The Lotus Garden. "A strange man my bridegroom is indeed," thought Anani as she sank into a chair. "From his manner, one would take oath he is indifferent, even scornful. Yet it is not so. Did he not send those others from the room that I might be more comfortable? Aye, he is gentle at heart. He must be." She lay back among her cushions, reaching for a half-finished piece of embroidery that lay on the table beside her. The poppy pod draft had just been dispatched to the king by one of the chamberlains, and already she was wishing she had not been so hasty in its preparation. Now again there was nothing to do, save think about the audience just past, and speculate about the next one. Surely he would not behave so oddly next time. She bent over her needlework, shoving out of her mind that first chilling scrutiny, under which she had felt she must sink straight through the gleaming pavements. That was not but the effect of his headache, and so were the other strange contradictions in his words and manner. They must be. Mara had said so. Dear Mara, how warm she was, how comforting. After the marriage, it will all come right, Anani assured herself. The king and I will understand each other, and I will be a good wife to him and comfort him when his head aches. Perhaps he would even let me go home sometime to see my brothers and the beautiful land of Canaan. The old hunger started up in her again at the thought of home. The sheep would be coming in over the green hills right now, their bells sounding faintly on the evening air, their tired shepherd outlined against the sky behind him. Oh, beloved Canaan. Anani looked up, biting off a scarlet thread, as Mara entered the room from her own chambers. At once, the hunger receded a little. She smiled, holding out her hand in welcome. "I have sent the potion, Mara. Come, sit beside me while I embroider, and talk to me of the king. Do you think he was pleased with me? A little? In spite of his headache?" "Of course, my princess." Mara crossed the room with that supple, swinging walk of hers, and sitting down beside Anani, began to chatter reassuringly of Thutmose and the splendid life awaiting his spouse. "How cool she is, how sure of herself," thought Anani wistfully. "I don't believe she is afraid of anything on earth. And she is not unhandsome, though of course she needs more meat on her bones to have a fine figure like my own. In Egypt, all women look half-starved. That blue flower is becoming, fastened there just above her forehead. It makes her eyes look like two more blue lilies down below it. Odd, only a single blossom. For my own part, I would have made a great wreath of them, using dozens of flowers and plenty of ribbons as well, with my hair flowing out all around it. But perhaps that would have been wrong. Mara always knows about these things. Strange that I should have grown so fond of this Egyptian maiden, whom I did not even know existed 3 weeks ago. Gentle Ishtar, what would I have done without her in this frightening land? Though I know not what my brothers would say of her, no doubt they would think her glance too bold, for certainly she does not keep her eyes downcast as a maiden should, and has no meekness in her. As for her dress... Inanni blushed and looked away from the narrow garment with its fluted, filmy sleeves, through which the lines of Mara's brown body were quite frankly visible. But that is the way things are done in Egypt, the princess thought nervously. It is not Mara alone who values coolness above modesty. The servant maids, that haughty queen herself. Inanni drew her shawl a little closer about her shoulders, reflecting that in some ways it was just as well her brothers had stayed at home in Canaan. If they had fully realized the wickedness to which their sheltered young sister would be exposed, they would have risen up in protest against this grand and wealthy marriage. Indeed, they would have. To Inanni's relief, the palace servants appeared at that moment to begin the elaborate ritual of serving the evening meal. She did not want to go on with her thoughts, to remember that whatever protests her brothers might have made, she would have journeyed to Egypt just the same. A Canaanite did not refuse a messenger of Pharaoh. An excellent dinner occupied both her thoughts and energies for a time. She was just beginning on her third pastry when Mara, who had finished some time ago, suggested an after-dinner stroll. "It is pleasant to walk abroad in the cool of the evening, and there is a garden with a great pool of lotus which we must surely visit. I saw it from the roof pavilion this morning." "Indeed," murmured Inanni. She found she did not want the pastry after all. "Of course I have no objection, Mara, but will there be many Egyptians there?" "In Egypt, one must expect Egyptians, my princess," said Mara with a smile. "But from the roof I saw no one but a gardener tending the flower beds. I hardly think it will be crowded." "But if it is a large garden..." Mara leaned forward on her elbows. "My princess, it is important that you show yourself. It must not be said that the king's intended hides like a timid hare in her own apartments." "No, no, of course not. It would not do, I see that. Let us go at once. I am ready. Dashtar! Yezra!" "I will not be afraid of these Egyptians," Inanni thought. "I must not be. Ah, but if only there were not so many of them, all looking at me out of their painted eyes." Moistening her lips and trying to ignore the tremors of her nervousness in the pit of her stomach, she gathered her long robes about her and, with Dashtar and Yezra in reluctant attendance, followed Mara down the hall to the outside stair. At the bottom, they found themselves in the first of a series of walled courts and gardens, through which they passed without encountering anyone more frightening than a few slaves or hurrying servants. Inanni began to relax. She peered curiously at the storerooms and shed-like workshops, catching glimpses of basket-makers and glass-blowers still at work, of hundreds of stacked wine jars, mountains of baled linen, the neat rows of a kitchen garden. There were vineyards, date groves, curving flower beds in which scarlet sage and larkspur glowed against dark tamarisk trees. As they entered a broad, paved area surrounded by weavers' stalls, Inanni gave a start of joy and stopped.
"Mara, look at that woman yonder," she whispered. "She who cards wool. Why, it is just so that we do it in Syria. I believe she is Syrian herself. I do indeed. Look you, Dashtar, is not that woman from our country?"
Mara said vaguely, "Indeed, she may be. Come, let us go on."
No, wait. I know she is Syrian.
Ah, Yezra, do you remember old Ninurta who taught us to handle the carter when we were children together?
Aye, mistress, and this woman resembles her a little, as I trust in Ishtar. The same broad brow, and the little downy mustache on the upper lip.
How happy we were then, sighed Inanni.
Mara was fidgeting, saying something about the lotus garden, but Inanni was lost in her homesick dreams. The woman with the carter looked up and smiled, and it was as if a small patch of Canaan opened up suddenly in this alien land, with old Ninurta holding out a hand in welcome.
I must talk to her, breathed the princess.
She started forward, but Mara caught her elbow.
Nay, Highness, we must not tarry here.
But why not? There are other days to see the lotus garden.
Indeed, Mara, I would rather sit a while with this woman from my homeland than visit 100 gardens. How kindly she looks at me. Perhaps she will let me ply the carter for a while, and we will talk about Canaan.
Nay, wait! Mara seemed almost alarmed. She recovered herself quickly, drawing Inanni aside.
I fear you forget yourself, Highness. Does a princess speak to a common weaver woman?
Indeed, in Egypt, this is not done.
But she seems most respectable.
She is beneath you. I know not what the son of Pharaoh would say if you so demeaned yourself.
Inanni flushed. Ah, I must learn to be Egyptian, she thought. The king will be ashamed of me.
She bent her shawled head and moved on in silence across the court.
It is, of course, possible, said Mara after a moment, that you speak to that woman in another way, in your own apartments, perhaps.
Yes, it would be quite proper for your highness to send for her.
Then why may I not speak to her here, thought Inanni.
Mara's tone seemed strangely unconvincing, even distraught. Inanni stole a backward glance across the courtyard at the Syrian woman's broad, kindly face and nimble fingers, away from which she was being led, aye, almost hurried, at a pace hardly suitable to an evening's stroll. What was the matter with Mara? Even now her smile was nervous, as if she were having to force herself to behave normally. Could it be that she was in a hurry, and had feared to be delayed in the court of the weavers? It was a surprising idea, but though Inanni did not see how it could be so, the more she thought of it, the more certain it seemed. They passed through the gate and stepped onto a wide pavement bordered by stone rams, the far end of which was blocked by high bronze doors and an armed sentry.
"What place is this?" inquired Inanni. "I believe it is one of the entrances to the palace grounds."
Mara stopped, her face quickening with interest.
"Aye, it is. Yonder doors pierce the great walls themselves, and on the other side is Thebes. Aye, princess, I would love to walk abroad in that city. A place of marvels it must be."
"Mara, come. That sentry is ogling you," whispered Inanni, tugging at Mara's sleeve in embarrassment.
Mara's eyes shifted to the sentry, measuring him so coolly that the princess hurried on, scandalized, across the pavement. Mara shrugged and followed.
"Aye, he is not so handsome as he thinks he is," she commented.
"Come through this wicket now. I think this is the hedge which borders our lotus garden."
Inanni was glad to dodge in anywhere away from the sentry's bold grin. But as they pushed through the last gate, he vanished from her mind. Her first impression of the lotus garden was of vast sweeping lawns and the sparkle of water. Her second, of a throng of people. She shrank back in dismay. But Mara had already started down a path strewn with powdered lapis lazuli, and there was nothing to do but follow. The place was almost a park, spacious and well-watered, dotted with clumps of palms and acacias, under which nobles and their ladies lounged. Beside them were low tables laden with beribboned wine jugs and bowls of fruit. Behind them, slaves waved great plumy fans.
Dominating all was the long, lotus-shaped sunken pool in the center of the garden, blue as heaven with countless lilies. Their perfume filled the air.
"Is it not beautiful, Highness? Is it not all I said and more?"
Anani mumbled assent, hoping she did not appear as gawky and countrified as she felt. "The whole court of Pharaoh must be gathered here to take the air." Two gossamer-clad ladies sauntered by, their fashionable blue-wigged heads like heavy flowers on their fragile necks, cones of slowly melting perfume ointment resting atop their curls. The fragrance of myrrh drifted by with them. A Nubian in a slave's shenty crossed the path, carrying a wine jug and a bouquet of golden cups.
"Lift up thy head, Rose of Canaan," came Mara's low voice. "Do not mind a few stares. Remember, it is not every day these lesser folk may gape at one destined to be the bride of royalty."
Mara's words were reassuring, as always, but her manner was preoccupied. She was scanning every part of the garden, a faint frown between her slanted eyebrows, the very lily on her forehead quivering with tenseness. Again, and stronger, the notion returned to Anani that her interpreter had business of her own in this place. Was she meeting someone? Perhaps a sweetheart? "Why, she could have told me," thought the princess. "I would have understood with all my heart." Mara turned just then, touching Anani's arm to guide her into a branching path. Her hand was like ice. Perhaps not a sweetheart, worried the princess. Perhaps someone she fears. They were making their way to a stone bench under a big acacia tree near the pool's edge. It was in plain sight of the rest of the garden, but some distance from the nearest group of courtiers, to Anani's relief. She sank down gratefully upon the bench and allowed Yezra to pour her a cup of wine from the flower-wreathed jug nearby. It had been no short walk, and when one possessed a fine, statuesque figure with plenty of curves, one got out of breath easily. It was good to rest.
"Shall I pluck you a lily, my princess?" Mara murmured.
Without waiting for permission, she moved down the grassy slope and stooped to the froth of blue flowers in the water. Rising, a blossom in her hand, she stood a moment to sweep the garden with yet another searching glance. Inanni found even herself peering this way and that, frowning into clumps of trees, though what or whom she sought, she did not know. At that moment, a light step sounded on the path behind her. She turned quickly. A tall figure was approaching through the shadows under a clump of palms. On the slope, Mara stopped short, then, with a visible effort, continued her unhurried walk back to the bench. She was breathing quickly as she bent over Anani and offered the lily's fragrance to her nose.
"Here is thy lotus, princess. Drink of its perfume and forget tomorrow, our sages tell us."
A smooth voice, speaking Egyptian, interrupted her. She straightened, then stepped aside. Anani found herself looking into the long, impenetrable eyes of a richly dressed young nobleman.
"Is this he, then, whom Mara expected?" she thought.
"But he is speaking to me."
"Who is he, Mara? What does he say?"
"Highness, may I present His Excellency, Lord Sheftu. He wishes to know if your Highness finds our country pleasing."
He must be the one, nevertheless, thought Anani, else Mara would not clasp her hand so tightly.
"Tell him it is very beautiful, though far different from my homeland."
Mara spoke, and the young lord listened courteously. He was the same, Inanni realized all at once, who had stepped up to the queen's throne this morning to receive some order. How attractive he was, to be sure, except for his beardless jaw, shaved clean as a baby's after the strange Egyptian custom.
Inanni narrowed her eyes, trying to picture him with a luxuriant Syrian beard. The results were exhilarating.
Ah, if this were Mara's young man, she had reason to breathe quickly. But of course he could not be, after all, since he was a great lord, and Mara only a hired interpreter. It was very confusing.
"My lord wishes to inquire if you enjoyed your audience with the king," Mara was saying.
"Oh, yes, indeed. His Highness was very kind." As Mara turned back to the young Egyptian, Inanni noticed that her tenseness was now pronounced, almost as if she were bracing herself for something she dreaded. Was she in love with this chef, too, or in mortal fear of him? Inanni could not decide. Evidently, what she was trying to tell him was of the gravest consequence, but he would not let her finish, and his voice was stern in spite of his mask of casual interest. "Can they really think I believe she is only translating my one little remark?" thought Inanni, almost amused. Of course, she might not have suspected, had she not guessed Mara was coming here to meet someone. It did take more time to say a thing in Egyptian, as Mara had explained this afternoon. Think how many words the king had used to make statements that were quite short and simple in Babylonian. A strange man, the king, scowling through his courtesies. But that had been quite different. Mara and this Lord Sheftu were actually talking of their own affairs. The young Egyptian made a remark, turning graciously to Inanni as he did so. She had opened her mouth to say that she had no objection to their conversing privately, that they need not pretend, when another thought struck her like a blow. Suppose it had not been different this afternoon? Suppose there were not such dissimilarities in the language? Suppose Mara and the king had been pretending, too?
"Lord Sheftu inquires," repeated Mara, "if you find the wine to your taste. Will you not answer, Highness?"
"It is very good," said Inanni mechanically.
"Impossible," she was thinking. "There could be no reason..." But she felt almost numb. This Sheftu was not interested in the wine. He was watching Mara out of the corner of his eye. Just so had it been at the audience. The king's manner bespeaking one thing and his words another. Before Baal, it was so. They were all deceiving her, thinking her too stupid to understand. Aye, and she had been stupid. She had believed because Mara told her to believe, because she wanted to believe.
"My lord inquires whether you enjoyed your journey, Highness."
"What? Yes. No. It doesn't matter what I say," she thought. "They're not listening to me, only to each other. I am of no importance. And the king, ah, Mara, why did you deceive me?" That was the part she could scarcely credit yet, that Mara would lie to her so callously. But she must have. It explained everything strange about that audience. The king's scowls and his honeyed words, even his restless pacing. Aye, it was true. Therefore, all she had been told was untrue. Thutmose was not kind. He was scornful and arrogant, as his first terrible scrutiny had indicated. He was not pleased with his intended. He despised her. "I want to go home," thought Inanni, closing her eyes. "Oh, gentle Ishtar, let me go home to my own land." Somehow she got through her part of the brief conversation, never knowing what she said. Before long, the young man bowed and went away. For some time, Inanni sat in silence, slowly, very slowly, accepting the truth. Mara, in the act of offering a platter of sweetmeats, bent over her in concern.
"My princess, are you ill?"
"No."
"But you are tired. Come, we will go back to the palace. It has been a long day."
Could she be pretending still? Thought Inanni, as she gathered her shawl about her. No, her voice is warm and sweet. Then why did she do this to me? Perhaps only to be kind, that I might not know my bridegroom scorns me. Bridegroom. Alas, he will never marry me. They walked slowly up the rise to the main path. The light had faded,
A few pale stars showed overhead, and the courtiers were drifting out of the garden. The fragrance of lotus came to Anani's nostrils, and the peace of the evening touched her with a gentle hand. Perhaps, after all, it is just as well, she thought. I could never have learned to be Egyptian, and wear those thin dresses and look down my nose at humble folk. The king would always have been ashamed of me. Still, if he had let me, I could have been a good wife to him and comforted him when his head ached. But he does not want that. It was never to be. I wonder why I was brought here, to live in loneliness, to no purpose. I suppose I shall never know. Some day, perhaps, when all their planning and struggling has spent itself, they will forget about me, and then I shall be allowed to go home again, down the long river to Canaan. No one will care then. They will not even remember.
You are very quiet, my princess, came Mara's worried voice. I trust I have not overwearied you.
Inanni smiled at her, shaking her head. Poor Mara. It was she who was weary with all her scheming and struggling. I will let her think I know nothing of this, thought the princess, and help her with her pretending that her secrets be not such a burden to her. Doubtless she, too, is caught in a web she cannot escape. But for Inanni, the struggle was over, and the fact brought an odd sense of relief which grew in her as they walked slowly through the dusk toward the gate in the hedge. Even the sidelong, curious glances from painted eyes had lost some of their power to hurt her, she discovered. It did not matter now what Egyptians thought of her. She did not have to win a place among them. Tomorrow, she thought, I will go alone to see the woman carding wool in the court of the weavers. It will be good to talk of home.
Chapter 11 Night Ride.
Now I have worn her out, Mara was thinking irritably, dragging her here and there, denying her even the small comfort of talking to that weaver. But how else could I have done it? I had to reach the garden. I had to. And now, great Amun, she must wait still another while before she might give Sheftu the king's message. If only she could have got it off her mind at once. But, of course, he was right. There were too many ears to listen in that place. She opened the gate and stepped back to let Inanni go through, checking off in her mind the instructions Sheftu had given her. This meeting had been merely to arrange for future meetings, since he dared not be seen with her often on the palace grounds. Tomorrow, he had said, she must contrive some method of slipping out secretly into the town by night, a means of coming and going whenever she chose through the palace walls. Tomorrow evening a guide would await her at the shop of Nefer, the goldsmith, just outside the walls, to conduct her to a place where she and Sheftu could talk in safety. She drew a long breath, following Inanni and her women through the garden gate and between the stone rams that bordered the wide paved drive. One day was a short time in which to make such difficult arrangements. She had no idea how to begin. As she stepped into the drive, she noticed Inanni pulling her shawl over her face, hurrying past the sentry with averted head. She is afraid I will stare the fellow down again, thought Mara with a flicker of amusement. Glancing at the guard, she found him once more obviously admiring her. Suddenly it occurred to her that he might be useful, very useful indeed. She sized him up, reflecting. He was young, well-favored enough to be easily flattered. Already his pacing had turned to a swagger under her gaze. And he guarded a gate which was apparently little used by the general traffic to and from the palace. Yes, it was worth a try. Mara gave him a melting glance, allowed a smile to play uncertainly about the corners of her mouth, then strolled after Inanni. Tomorrow evening, when he came on duty again, she would make his acquaintance. The incident restored her confidence. As they passed rapidly through the deserted court of the weavers and the string of little gardens and courts that led back to the stairway, She found her worries fading before a mischievous anticipation of tomorrow and her next encounter with the sentry. It would be amusing to wind him about her finger, exciting to venture for the first time into the streets of Thebes. As for the king's message, that concerned only Sheftu. Play your own game, my girl. But she had not finished her encounters for today. She had scarcely bid Inanni goodnight and retired to her own room when a soft scratching sounded on the door leading to the corridor. Frowning, Mara went to open it. At once a Libyan in a slave's shenty pushed into the room and closed the door silently and swiftly behind him.
"You're to come with me," he muttered. "Get a cloak."
Mara's jaw set angrily. She had never seen the man before, but her dislike of him was instantaneous. Everything about him repelled her. His pale foreign skin and colorless hair. The one blind eye which showed milky blue in his callous face. Above all, the insolence with which he ordered her around.
"Which devil's brother are you?" she spat at him. For answer, he reached into his sash and produced something which he held out indifferently on a hand, like a chunk of beef. It was a scarab identical to the one Mara's master had given her in Menfi.
Suddenly, she turned to fetch a cloak. The Libyan pulled a fold of it half over her face before he motioned her into the hall. A few minutes later, they were passing down an outer stair and through a series of unfamiliar star-lit courtyards toward what Mara's nose told her were the palace stables. They pushed through a row of acacia bushes and emerged into a stone drive.
"Wait,"
grunted the Libyan. It was very quiet after the pad of his sandals died away up the drive. Mara could hear only the light breeze stirring in the acacia leaves, and farther away, the gutturals of the stable boys and the occasional thump of a hoof. The sharp, clean smell of horses came strong to her nostrils, almost obliterating the fainter but ever-present fragrance of lotus that rose on the night air from 100 palace gardens. It would be nice, it would be lovely, thought Mara, just to stretch out yonder on the grass, with the stars thick up above and the breeze cool, and nothing on my mind. Suddenly, she felt tired all through. Why did he have to send for me tonight? She thought. Tomorrow would have done as well. The silence was shattered as a chariot clattered into view around a bend in the drive. The horses came to a prancing halt just opposite Mara, and the Libyan motioned her in with an impatient jerk of his head. Reluctantly, she stepped up beside him and took a firm grip on the chariot's curving side.
"Pull the cloak over your face,"
he ordered. With a crack of his whip, they lurched forward. For the next few minutes, Mara had all she could do to keep her footing as they rattled along at a furious pace, swerving presently into a wider drive lined with torches and alive with traffic. Other chariots hurtled past them, the drivers shouting and popping the whips as was the Libyan. Half blinded by her muffling cloak and jarred to the bone, Mara had little chance to examine her surroundings. But she guessed the chariot was speeding down the Great East Avenue toward the main gate. A moment later, they pulled up briefly under a glaring torch, and the Libyan muttered something to a man who stood there. A sentry, Mara imagined, though she caught no more than a glimpse of him. She had barely time to plant her feet and renew her grip on the chariot's side when they were off again, whirling out of the palace grounds and through the dark streets of western Thebes. It was obvious the Libyan was accustomed to driving for great nobles, for he kept the horses at a full gallop, with arrogant disregard of comfort, caution, or the safety of occasional pedestrians, who scattered like birds frightened from their marsh. Mara clung to the rail with aching fingers, banging her ribs against the side at every corner, and wishing her master and his surly Libyan at the bottom of the Nile. She was bruised and sore when at last the horses turned through a tall gateway into a dimly lit courtyard. Snorting and tossing their plumed heads,
The beasts halted before a door that appeared to lead into the side wing of a large and impressive house. A groom appeared out of nowhere to take the reins, and the Libyan stepped down, pushing Mara before him.
"This way,"
he said. She followed, too weary and confused to notice or care where he was leading her. Inside, the hall smelled faintly of wine and expensive ointments. She caught a whiff of baking pastry as they crossed a passageway. Far off, in another part of the house, there were sounds of music and merriment, as if a party were in progress.
"In there,"
muttered the Libyan, stopping with a jerk of his head before an open door. She stepped into a small tapestry-hung room, and a tall, spare figure rose from a corner to confront her. Involuntarily, she fell back a step. Her master's countenance had grown no more winsome in the hours since morning.
"Insolent, show more respect to your betters,"
growled the Libyan, nudging her forward again. She glared at him, but grudgingly moved her right hand to her left shoulder. The thin smile she remembered all too well from Menfi twisted her master's lips as he strolled toward her.
"Docile as ever,"
he commented.
"I see you have struck up a warm friendship with my servant Shadzar. Did you enjoy the ride?"
"Enjoy?" muttered Mara resentfully. "He drives as if the Devourer were after him." Again, the acid smile.
"He has other talents, too, especially with that whip he carries. It is well you came with him without argument."
Mara preserved a sullen silence, mentally cursing him and his Shadzar and all their relatives in two languages. She felt wearier than ever. Perhaps he would let her sit down. Instead, he sat down himself, waving an abrupt dismissal to the Libyan. When the door had closed, he stated,
"You have had audience with the Pretender."
"Aye."
"What did you learn?"
"Not of interest."
"And why not?"
His voice turned icy. "Take care, my girl," thought Mara. "You'd best bestir yourself and dance to his tune. You can be tired later."
"It was no fault of mine, master," she explained in a more conciliatory